is not adrenal. This is not adrenal. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One from Eagle Speak. We appreciate everybody who is either joining us live or subscribes to the podcast and catches us at a better time to your convenience. If you are with that group that is joining us live, I'd like to invite you, if you scroll down to the bottom of the show page, that's where you will find the chat room. And we've already got some folks there in the chat room. Jerry Hendricks, he's joined us along with Paul, our ever loyal Paul, who catches almost every show. If Paul doesn't show up more than two shows in a row, I'm going to get worried about him. And of course, we have NEC 338 as well. So if you'd like to, scroll down, join the chat room, especially for today's show where we're doing a free-for-all. If there are some topics you would like for us to address or some questions you just wanted to ask my co-host and I, put it in there. We'll grab it and we'll integrate it into the show. We have a few bold-faced items that we put out there in the show prep, but we're going to just bounce around and do pretty much what we want to do. Also, we like to, if you are so inclined, to open up the phone lines. So the studio line is open. It's area code 347-308-8397. It's also on the show page there. If you'd like to call in, you're more than welcome to. But besides that, glad to be here. Eagle One, happy December to you.
Thank you. I have my annual cold, so if I sound a little rough, it's because my grandchildren visited and carrying all the diseases they get at elementary and preschool.
The petri dish of blessings as well. But well, you sound as great as always. We should persevere. We'll see what happens at the 45-minute mark. That's
when
the mute
now.
Button comes into play. Well, as we mentioned on the show, I guess we should start the show on. It is kind of a sad note because 47 is, and it might be hard for young men and women to believe who are in their 20s or early 30s, but 47, you are really, you're hitting your stride, your prime. And for those that have been around the Navy blogosphere for a while or have been with Midrat since our start almost 13 years ago, some of y'all might be aware, others may not, when we first started off, we had three co-hosts on Midrats. We had Eagle One, we had myself, and we also had Gallarin, otherwise known as Raymond Pritchett. And he was with us for most of the first year until life had to pull him off. He had to get his Sundays back. And he was the founder of the blog Information Dissemination, which Raymond started blogging about three, four years after we did in that first group of people. And his readership grew really fast, and it grew fast for all the right reasons. He's a very sharp man. His specialty was IT, especially his last job was in cybersecurity for a major U.S. bank, which is why a lot of us missed him as part of the information space. But you can understand in a job like that, not only is it demanding of time, that your employer also probably asks you to be a little more discreet. For those, and I would point them that way, if you can go to my blog. I have a link to it. Raymond was one of the great speakers, along with one of our callers last game, Mark Vandroff, last Midrats. He was one of the big speakers at NavyCon 1 that we had in Annapolis that now goes every year. It was a great demonstration. If you had never met Raymond in person, you can get to hear his voice for his writing that he did over information dissemination. And one of the great things about Raymond was not just what he did personally, but if you go over to information dissemination, it's still up. Look at the other authors that he brought on. He just didn't keep it to himself. You're going to recognize a lot of the co-authors that he brought in to write. And this was before a lot of the group blogs that morphed into really online magazines. That was before War on the Rocks. That was before 1945. That was before Task and Purpose. All these other places that a lot of people will put their work if they don't have their own individual blog. And information dissemination is one of the places that did that. And Raymond introduced some new people, but he also gave a platform to some people like Robert Farley, Brian McGrath, and a few others that have been an important part of the discussion. And I just wanted to, when it became apparent, he passed away a few days before Thanksgiving. When word got out that Raymond had passed, even though he hasn't been that active in the information space for years, we had him on for our sixth anniversary show on Midrat. I wish we'd done it more often, but that you don't know what life brings. Admiral John Harvey, that most of y'all remember, I think Admiral Harvey said something really nice. He replied to one of the announcements, I think the one that Dr. Farley put out on Twitter. And Admiral Harvey said, quote, speaking of Raymond, quote, "His insights, analysis, and contributions to the Navy were truly extraordinary. Tough love has never been delivered with more wisdom," end of quote. And I think that's a standard we should all aspire to. And that wasn't exaggerating for Raymond. So for those that didn't know Raymond, maybe spend some time over at Information Dissemination. Maybe watch what he did at NavyCon 1. But for those of us that have known him, either online or had the pleasure, and in person, he was a fun guy. If you had read his stuff online, that's pretty much what he was like in person. But he was even more funny, and he would also share his love for his family in a way that he usually didn't do in public. Please take an opportunity, if you're not familiar with Raymond, to look at what he written. And I think we're all expected that he would come back to the information space at some point. Fate had other plans. So, Raymond, we loved you. It was great having you on board, and we'll miss you. Over to you.
Yeah, I got a chance to meet him in at one of the selling shows for the 1921 plans, the Navy plans when Brian McGrath, I think, was pushing his stuff out. And he was a great guy and a lot of fun to be with, as you say. The amazing thing to me is, for a guy who had no military experience, was how because of his intelligence and because of the way he approached things, he had an amazing impact on the Navy, and he got to do things and got access to people that is really astonishing for someone in his position. And I was stunned when I found out that he had not that he died, and as you say, 47 is awfully young, and it's a shame. I hope for his family that they have nothing but fond memories, and that they will continue on in his tradition of being good people.
Yeah, he was good people. He didn't suffer fools very well. If you ask him what he thought about something, he would always tell you, but he'd do it with a little wry look on his eye. He was just a great guy. He was originally from Arkansas, but he's spent at least the time that I've known him, since 2007, he's been in the Mid-Atlantic, New York area. So as an expat Southerner, and I lived up in New England as well, so we would do our little regional comparisons, and we had a lot of fun with it. But you brought up something, and I think I had mentioned this to a few folks, is And this is goes back to a topic that, that we've talked with guests with over the years, and I know you've talked to people like this as well. Is there are people out there who are really smart, but maybe they never wore the uniform, or maybe they're just a 24-year-old JO, or maybe they're just some guy who just finished his PhD and is working on the Hill as a gnome, but they've got good ideas. And I don't know whether it's stage fright or that specter that haunts a lot of really good people, imposter syndrome or whatever, that people won't step into the space. Or if they do step into the space, somebody will come at them and is like, what are you talking about this? You never served, or you don't have an advanced degree in this. You can't talk about that. Raymond didn't come from a Navy background, but the Navy was his passion. And he was kind of, in a slightly different way, but he was kind of like Tom Clancy, who was an insurance salesman. But he had a sharp intellect and a great interest in the Navy. And he picked up a lot that people who spent decades in uniform didn't get. And he put his thoughts together and he brought in and he talked to people who could fill in some knowledge gaps for him. And he, that's what made him a very important person in the conversation space. And I always used him as an example when I would talk to people to get them to write or to get them to engage, and sometimes to get them to come on Midrats. And they would be hesitant or perhaps too humble. And we could always point to Raymond and say, hey, you know, if he can do it, you can do it. Just step out there in the marketplace of ideas. If you have good ideas or observations or commentary that you want to put out there, put out there. See what happens. And he did it really well. And I think he, and again, I would encourage people to go over to Information Dissemination and look at some of the people he brought on to also write there. And it, the more voices, the better, I think. If it's something that's not of value, the marketplace will vote accordingly. But if it's something of significance, it'll rise to the top. Just like, you know, you and I we've had a few of them on guests here. Is there are people who are just a couple years out of college that have insights and observations and ideas that are of a much higher quality than the most credentialed people in the world. And that's one thing that I think Raymond was a great example, who continued to be a great example of that. The downside to that, however, is there will be people who will find themselves in situations kind of like Raymond, where you've got a paying gig that has to be your priority because that's how you take care of your family. And some of those people back out of the space because they need to for larger reasons. And maybe they'll come back, maybe they won't. But that's I think, also is part of Raymond's legacy in that regard that we can still point to.
Yeah, we've had a number of young civilians and young officers come on the show. And the nice thing about it is, I mean, you know, the stuff they said, I don't see how anybody could, you know, if the fear is of being ridiculed or being wrong, well, all of us are wrong about some things, but these guys have been really sharp and presented arguments that you know, all of us, you know, you look at it and you go, I never thought of it that way, but it's helpful to get that different perspective, and that was what Raymond was good about. He gave us a different slant on things. He wasn't hidebound by being a SWO or being an NFO or being a pilot or being a supply officer or whatever else you could be. You know, he was Raymond, and he took things that he saw that he thought were interesting and followed up on them. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, it, you know, it opens the mind, but also makes him a little bit fearless, which is a good feature. And we've got a caller coming in, and hey, they're taking us up on our offer. Area code 703, you're live on Midrat. So good afternoon.
Hey, Sal and Eagle One, this is Jerry. And I wanted to call about Raymond and really the huge impact that he had, you know, not only because of the level of analysis that he did, which I was, you know, really, quite frankly, shocked, you know, when I found out that he did not have a naval background. But you're right. I think the Tom Clancy analogy is useful because he didn't make many mistakes when he was looking at things. He seemed to have a technical acumen that that you know far surpassed really you know what you would expect. But the thing that I was most grateful for, and I tried to reach out to the family, you know, through various different channels, is that in 2008, you know, when I wrote my essay about Buy Fords, Not Ferraris, you know, it got into proceedings and it got a little bit of a bump. But it wasn't until Raymond elevated the conversation at information dissemination and that I really began to realize how many people inside the building, where I was working at the time, I was inside the Pentagon as a staff officer, but suddenly, you know, everyone's talking about, you know, hey, did you see the analysis that he did about your essay? And all of a sudden, you know, he had an amplifier that really resounded around the Navy, around the Pentagon. And if he latched hold of an idea and started to trot it out and examine it and turn it over, you know, sometimes it make you a little uncomfortable because he was sort of unsparing in his critical analysis. But if he liked it, if it passed his sniff test, then, you know, suddenly, you know, you were on a radar because of his sponsorship. And so in many ways, and I say this with all, you know, honesty, in many ways, you know, my path out of the Navy after I retired to go to work in a think tank and then ultimately in analysis in many ways was pushed along by Gowron, by Raymond Pritchett, who's helped to elevate my profile and then really gave me some good positive feedback, made me feel better about writing and taking on the system because, hey, if you could pass his sniff test, then maybe I wasn't so far off. And I think as we look at, you know, sort of the challenges, you know, we had debates within the Naval Institute about the direction of the Institute. I remember gathering Ray and a couple other bloggers when I was the director of Naval History to sit at the old general board conference table to kind of talk about where we were going. It really, there was some years there around, you know, 2008 through about 2015 where there was some real churn. And it felt like we were moving in a direction. It didn't seem like we got there, but boy, it was a hopeful time, and it was hopeful in many ways because of the work and the effort and the energy of Ray. So I was so glad, Sal, for what you wrote at your blog site, and then also that you brought it up this weekend.
You know, you mentioned that time period, and I think I outlined that as like, you know, phase three or whatever that went up to about 2016. And, you know, I think what it was, and this is still there to a certain extent, but the antibodies of the system have gone against it. But a lot of the interest in Raymond and what he wrote was the fact there is a hunger out there in senior uniform and civilian leadership. I mean, Bob Work and Raymond were talking back in the day on a regular basis for good reason. Is people want to hear objective opinion because the people they're around with each other on their staffs, their organizations, or if they're a political appointee, the people they have in the office, there might be some trust there, but a lot of these people, you don't know what their agenda is, what their real opinion is. Are they telling me this because I'm their boss? Or they want something from me? Or are they actually telling me this because this is what they think? You know, I just outlined this. Does everybody approve? You know, why not? What am I missing? Where if you have somebody who is objective and doesn't seem to have any agenda except for ideas, like Raymond was, people find that interesting. They want to talk to those people because they don't owe them anything, and they don't want anything. And Raymond didn't. And I got the quote I did from John Harvey earlier, and there are other ones out there from pretty significant people that if you told them there was this guy from Arkansas who worked in IP that was typing away on a blog by himself within – you know, 48 months, he would be talking and influencing the following people. They wouldn't believe, but it's just one of those things that was a great credit to him. But as I kind of mentioned earlier, I think a benchmark there for those who want to be part of the conversation, but maybe are holding back for one reason or another. Didn't hold Raymond back, and you've met him in person too. He didn't hold back from anything, any type of opinion, but he did it in the right way.
I agree, and thank you again. I'll listen in on the podcast.
Thanks, Jerry. We appreciate you dialing in.
Okay. Where are we?
Well, there we go. Some of the folks have made comments in the chat room. And anyway, that was a good thing about the internet is if people want to go back and see what Raymond has written over the course of the years, it's always going to be available to us. And I guess tip a hat and hopefully we won't be joining Raymond anytime soon, but 47 is a lot earlier. His, I would offer if there are people that want to give a comment of condolence directly to Raymond's family. Raymond's Facebook page is, I think it's one of his daughters. I could be wrong here. They have the password and they are monitoring it. So if somebody wanted to go, who was on Facebook, wanted to go over to Raymond's page and make a note that his family will see that. So I guess we can move on to the next, I guess, topic of discussion. We kind of covered this pretty good in the pre-show. Maybe we should record the pre-show. But one of the most fascinating things, and it doesn't just apply to the topic at hand for me, or our critical aspects of military economy or just plain human living that have been around for a long time, but they become, in times of peace and quiet and security, they just become part of the background noise. They're just part of nature. You don't appreciate what you have. It's kind of like a 21st century American getting, nobody ever quite, well, some people do. But generally speaking, you turn on the tap, you clean water, and you're off and running. But previous generations, and in many parts of the world, that's not true. And part of that is, we still don't have a final word, if we ever will, the Nord Stream 1 and 2 pipelines under the Baltic Sea were blown up. And that had everybody not just waking up to the vulnerability of those gas pipelines, which are always really exciting when they blow up because they create nice bubbles and occasional flames, but the fact that so much of what the world runs on, not just gas, internet connectivity, telephones, banking information all over the world, runs on cables under the ground. And I know that you've done a little bit of reading up on that. And I guess for the listeners, give them kind of underwater cable 101. And I'll just offer to folks, if you haven't seen a graph, a chart of all the undersea cables, do that. And then picture all the water gone. And that gives you an idea of the incredible infrastructure that's just under there by itself, relatively unprotected under the water.
Yeah, it's pretty, I started digging into this because we said we were going to do it on the show, but it's pretty interesting. I mean, they're about 95%+ of all international communications flows through these international cables that run under the oceans. And, you know, if that was disrupted, you can imagine all the financial data, not just the sending pictures to your grandparents of your kids, but all the international finance, all the business deals, military communications. It's just incredible the amount of stuff that goes through there. And it would be very disruptive if someone cut those cables. So the U.S., I think, has like 300 different cables that come into the U.S. And these things have, for the most part, the cables are laid in the ocean, and they're deep enough, and they're buried 3 or 4 or 5 feet under the bed of the ocean, except in the areas where you can't do that, and they try and avoid valleys, undersea valleys and stuff. But the thing is, there are two things you worry about. One is that somebody's going to develop a submarine, gosh, like the Russians, who have this research vessel that contains a submarine that is a manned submarine to go down and tap into these cables. And this research vessel, Russians have the Taran, I think it is, bobs around and has shown up in various places like off Ireland. The Antar is the name of this thing. Showed up near Ireland, where or up in the Shetlands, where these cables have connections, and there's another Russian ship, the actual one that showed up in the Shetlands, right after the cables got cut up there. And the question was being asked, well, are the Russians sending a message that they can do this? And the other concerns you have is where the cables come into the country. There are not that many locations where these cables come in. They're like around New York City. There are several locations, but it's, you know, it's not thousands. It's a few. There's some on the West Coast in California, Oregon, and Washington State. And then we have these lines that go through Hawaii and Guam and out into the Pacific. If you saw the tweet I put up to advertise the show, it's an incredible and dynamic system of these communication lines. And the question is, what are we doing to protect them? And that is it's really a challenge. Once you dig into this, you go, well, how do you protect these? You know, somebody's got to protect them on shore so nobody can blow up the connections on land at places where these cables come in. But what do you do to protect them out in the middle of the ocean? And if they do get damaged, how do you repair them? The answer to that is and the same thing with underwater pipelines from the various oil and gas fields off the U.S. coast, off the Gulf of Mexico, off the coast of California, off and all the North Sea infrastructure for the oil and gas rigs up there. Well, how do you deal with a problem? And the answer is you have to have some kind of cable or pipeline repair vessels that are capable of going down and doing the work to fix those things. Now, the question then becomes, well, who's in charge of this? Who's in charge with defending these lines, these vital lines of communication? And has someone pointed out, a guy named Robert Martinage, said no government agency or department, this is U.S. government, has responsibility for the defense of the country's energy and cable infrastructure. So who's going to do that? You know, the Coast Guard has some responsibility for things that are inshore or in port, but they don't really go off into the deep water. So who is going to defend these lines and protect them against any kind of sabotage? And the initial response to this has been that, you know, well, is it legal for someone to cut your lines? And the answer is, if they're out in the middle of the ocean, probably. If there's war going on, we did it in the past. We cut the Spanish telegraph lines from Cuba and the Philippines way back in 1898. But, you know, various agreements have been that we wouldn't do that unless there's a war going on. The Brits cut the German telegraph lines in World War I. They seem to have messed around with them. In fact, they tapped into them in World War I to help get some of the coded material they later broke, and including like the Zimmerman telegram. That's how they got that. The in World War II, they may have cut them again. But the So it is possible during wartime to cut these things, and nobody's going to do that much about it if it's a war. You got to figure that's going to happen. But what about in a non-war situation when you've got these gray area things? You know, somebody goes, well, we don't know who did that. Who would do such a terrible thing? And, you know, that is the problem in the current world, is that we don't know sometimes who would do this. So the U.S. government, Congress, did pass a plan for the Department of Transportation, our friends at MARAD, as a matter of fact, to institute a thing called the Cable Security Program. Actually, Cable Security Fleet. And the fleet consists of two ships, which are civilian manned, U.S. flagships with U.S. crews, but they're a civilian. They're owned by a company that the U.S. government pays $5 million a year each to have these cable repair ships hanging, standing around. But here's what you get when you look into this cable security fleet program. The Department of Transportation doesn't like it. They don't want it, and they're not going to fund it. So they got funded for 1 year for $10 million. And then the next year, 2022, they didn't fund it, despite the fact this one person, hold on, I got this cold, has one person said they just canceled the program. They deleted funding despite the fact they received billions of dollars under the infrastructure law. The DOT deleted funding for the modest $10 million annual stipend needed to continue funding the cable security fleet. And this is according to Douglas Burnett. Okay. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, the amazing thing is that change you find under the soap cushion money. And when you look at our economy, and I've said this once, I'll say it 1,000 times, and I have a nice long draft on the topic that I've actually had since the fall of 2020. Maybe I'll publish it someday. Anyway, we're a maritime and aerospace nation, and our economy and really our civil society relies on a lot of things that people just don't see. And the underwater cables that carry, you know, you mentioned the underground pipes that bring in oil from off the coast, off of Louisiana, not to mention, you know, gas pipes as well, the information, the internet, the phones, the communications, and the fact that it's not guarded, and we just assume its safety. And part of it, I think, there's also a little bit of a challenge here, is you have high-end threats and low-end threats. The high-end threat, ironically, might be one of the easiest ones to go after. That's something where you have a submarine, a special submarine. We have special submarines. The Russians have special submarines. The Chinese have special submarines, I think. They can go do special things. That's keeping track of what they're doing is anti-submarine warfare. You also have not necessarily blowing up or, like you mentioned, tapping into those information lines for espionage purposes. And blowing them up can be something that we saw in the Baltic that involved explosives, but you also have the low-end threat where now a lot of this is very, very deep at the bottom of the Atlantic and the Pacific Ocean, thousands of feet deep. But everybody has a continental shelf, and when they come up, all you need is a trawler and a big grappling hook on the back and some idea where they are. And this has happened before, and you just drag those puppies up. Or if you want to get kinetic about it, all these things do come ashore someplace. But, you know, that's perhaps a harder problem than it is going 175 miles off a coast with a nondescript third-party trawler and just pulling that puppy up or sending somebody down. So how do you defend that? Are there ways you can monitor cables remotely? I'm sure there are some ways, but at the end of the day, you have to have good surveillance to know, you know, forget the submarines, just the surface ships. Where are your cables? What are the ships near the cables? And you are going to have ships out there that are going to be able to go investigate those ships during times of advanced crisis. The time to fix a cable break is not after it's been sabotaged, but to catch the person who's going out there to sabotage it. And of course, that opens up, you know, one of our favorite areas. The Brits use the phrase, I don't think they're going to adopt it, which is a shame, the militarized version of the offshore supply vessels. They were going to call the sloop of war. The Danes have things that are very similar. They're can handle high seas, long endurance, any range. You know, that might be something off the shelf you would have to get to do that type of security. Commandeer stuff from the oil industry that would make them very happy, and they need to do that to keep their oil stuff going. But that would, I always wind up saying stuff like this because it's true, but that would be a great mission for like the Naval Reserve or even the Coast Guard Reserve, is to have those capabilities and those people who are trained for it, because you don't need it full time. But when things ratchet up, pick up the phone and all of a sudden you've got a half dozen on each coast that are ready to do that type of security mission. And kind of the offshore version of what the Naval Reserve used to have, and I think they still do, but just at a lower amount. You could probably come at this a little better. They're import security detachments. You know, that's another way to look at it. So looking at that vulnerability, the old critical capabilities versus critical vulnerabilities discussion, this might be an opportunity to extend that conversation. Look what happened in Nord Stream 1, Nord Stream 2. Let me tell you what's going to happen to and what the banking in New York and London rely on. Let's talk about how we get hydrocarbons from the Gulf of Mexico into Louisiana. It's a complicated target, and I'm going to channel a couple of our buddies here, Sal Mercogliano and John Conrad. Where's my maritime department? If the Department of Transportation doesn't want to do it, if the Department of Defense doesn't want to do it, you know, if we had a maritime department, that might be a good place for it to go, but somebody has to take ownership of it. I don't think Department of Transportation's the place you want to put it.
Yeah, it's really interesting that this when Doug Burnett was writing about this, he said this: the irrefutable position that the submarine cables and the ships that lay and repair them are critical has the strong endorsement of all national security agencies. But this was not enough to sway some of the senior DOT officials who overrode DOT's own MARAD to kill CSP, which I think he meant CSF, the cable security fleet, when it was first introduced in Congress. However, Congress recognized the compelling national security need and acted to set the thing up, but the DOT people still didn't want to do it. So it says, you know, DOT opposition is tied to bureaucratic complacency, outdated misconceptions of modern international communication technology, and the potential disruptive impact, and an unexplained view that protecting cables is not important or is a problem for others because transporting data is not DOT's concern. Even though then Secretary of Transportation Elaine Chao wisely directed DOT civil servants to stop delaying implementation of the law, DOT tried repeatedly but unsuccessfully to prevent implementation through bureaucratic holding tactics. So that is a pretty stinging indictment of the DOT and why they shouldn't be and maybe shouldn't be involved in this. But you know, is the Navy going to take on this mission? I mean, we have in the MSC fleet right now, I think, two cable layers left over from the days of SOSIS and the other, they were replaced at the IUSS, whatever it was. You know, and so that's important for Navy purposes, but there, you know, that's good, but I can't believe we're spending $5 million, only $5 million a year to keep a couple of other cable repair ships around, and they're too blind to do that. So it's just one of those inexplicable things.
In a way, it is explicable, because what you described there, the bureaucratic slow rolling of the, what do all the cool kids call it, the deep state, it
yep.
reminds me of the critique people have of the State Department. And this is decades long, is you have this permanent bureaucracy who seems more interested in preserving their own habits and their own mortgage payment in Alexandria than they do actually pursuing the interests of the U.S. And you have people who are forward, whether they're ambassadors or whether they're people in the cable layers, who know what the mission is, know the criticality, but they work within a certain bureaucratic structure. And when they try to work through that structure, they find that their biggest opponent is not the mission, it's not other nations, it's their own people who have been assigned in their Civil Service Act protected position to do something besides what is really their job. So maybe we need civil service reform, Freudian slip, civil service reform at the Department of Transportation as well as the Department of State. And it's, we had a couple of our guests who have actually had to wrestle with this beast, talk about it. But that is one of the things that I don't know what right combination of political appointees and top cover it will take, but our government bureaucrats are starting to look less like the government system that won World War II and the Cold War, and more like something in line with the Ottomans and the European Union, and that it's more of a jobs program and a social status preservation program than it is actually doing the nation's bidding. That might be a little extreme, but it's always been kind of a pet peeve of mine, is the fact that a lot of people, we see that in the Navy as well, when people are trying to work an idea, a concept, and the people who've been in the bureaucracy for a long, long time and know how to make it work, they can absolutely stop and derail and end anything that they don't really want to see for whatever reason it might be. If they're on your side, I guess that's a feature. If they're not on your side, it's a bug. But as an attorney knows, complexity is a tax. Complexity is also a defensive mechanism that people can use for, if it's not job preservation, it can be rent seeking, it can be a variety of things via regulations and bureaucracies. I don't know if we've ever actually had a time where either one has shrunk, but each year more of it grows, the harder it's going to be for people to address issues just like we're talking about that have been neglected, that need some attention. But I'll guarantee you that when war comes and people don't have their internet and they cannot communicate and they can't heat their homes, they're going to ask why. And the answer is going to be surprising to some people.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's already happened. And a lot of times things have happened due to earthquakes and, you know, so Japan after the tsunami took out stuff. I mean, they lost a lot of their cables into them. The people in Tonga, as you may remember, I think they have a single line in there that got, you know, and it's not a matter of just, oh yeah, it's broken, we'll send out Joe in the boat and we'll drop some more cable. I mean, you know, this takes months to recover from this. It is not a simple problem. The Brits, by the way, have decided they're going to go with a new Royal Navy surveillance ship, multi-role ocean surveillance ship, to help look at the problem of dealing with the cable and pipeline underwater pipeline issues. The Norwegians have been talking about developing some kind of system that would identify when some threat, it sounds an awful lot like sonar or SOSIS or something, is near their pipelines. It's not like there aren't, I mean, when I say there are 700,000 miles of these lines. I mean, it's a huge problem, and the thing is, like, even if they don't take all of them down, let's say you take down a couple of the major ones, the load would shift to some of the other ones, but that means everything gets slowed down, and you know, that can crash your system too. So it is a challenging problem. And I don't see that anybody's particularly decided to take this on. So,
I remember, and I looked around and I couldn't find it. I'm sure it's out there if you dove into the hobbyist websites. But I remember the situation with Tonga you described. Basically, they dropped off the map. They had no communications. And I'll guarantee you, just like everybody has around here, you've got that the cranky person that has a gate on their property that says trespassers will be shot, but you can see at the end of their property there's this antenna sticking up. Is there a lot of people who are ham radio, which is, you know, long HF, long wave, depending on the atmospherics and the frequency, you can hop almost across the planet. That and this has happened a few times of other natural disasters, is a couple of those old cranks that have shortwave radio, people knock on their door and say, we got to get some information out. And you very quickly fall back to 130 years ago. Our technology is great and wonderful, but it is incredibly delicate. And you mentioned the UK. I'm not surprised that they're trying to address this, because that island nation knows really well. I mean, she can't feed herself. She has North Sea oil, but you talked to a friend of mine from college. She works in the IT industry in Aberdeen, which is kind of their version of Stavanger, Norway, or our Houston, Texas, kind of their energy capital. It's amazing the amount of information that comes through those areas. If all that stuff shuts down, it quickly becomes economically existential, because they are really, really, really sensitive. So it'll be interesting to watch what the UK does. I think here in America, unless something ridiculous happens, we probably won't be able to get much traction on it, unless we have somebody, a political appointee, who has it on, you know, their agenda to make it happen and knows how to use the bureaucracy in that direction. And it's not that, when you compare the potential economic impact and industrial impact, which is your warfighting impact, the cost of that compared to the cost of securing it, there's a huge differential there. But again, it goes to understanding the problem, understanding the challenge. You know, who in Congress can we point to that, when you slap that map up there of all the undersea cables, are really going to understand that? I can count on one hand right now, and a couple of them will not be here in the new year, who would be able to understand that. And ultimately, that's where your funding is going to be, or really the only place that you have to push back against an executive branch who may not have that in their top 150.
Well, the trouble is those cables aren't anybody's voting area. You know, none of their constituents are out in the middle of the Atlantic, you know, so that, you know, yeah, it's a problem, but, you know, I need to worry more about X, which is a domestic issue. But you were talking about the shortwave radio people. I know in the National Weather Service uses these shortwave radio operators, ham radio operators, when we've got a severe storm and knocks out the power, knocks out everything. These folks have, you know, they're wired in their cars, they've got extra batteries, you know, and they provide a real service to the community. So we have the infrastructure in some ways for that, so that, you know, we know that can be done, but why is that complicated when you're going to try and get the kind of message traffic we send now compared to what we used to send to make things work? And Paul makes a good point. The pipelines and the cables are all owned by private industry, and maybe multiple corporations will have a share in any given undersea cable. But that also complicates matter because there are international companies are involved too. In fact, one of the concerns is that China wants to horn in on some of these cables, which is probably the last thing we need for them to do. So,
yeah, but Huawei of the seas, that would be interesting in a variety of ways. It goes to that.
There is a Huawei Marine, by the way.
Of course there is. And all this stuff runs on software, and you don't have to have a bunch of C4 or a grappling hook to blow up a internet cable, to blow up a data cable, to blow up a voice cable. You just have to have malicious software or hardware that, when it receives a certain code, destroys itself. It's you don't have to write a sequel to Ghost Fleet or any of those other science fiction novels to be able to go through a few scenarios there. But I guess there's also, with all the private ownership, because we've seen this in other areas of the economy, there's also huge legal issues of what you can access, what you can control, what do you do, who has access. But it's not a challenge that's going to become a lesser of a larger challenge if you don't even have the people responsible for it right now. The Department of Transportation is going to take an interest in it. It will just have to wait until it becomes a crisis. Kind of like, last week, do a quick segue here. Last week when we had our free-for-all discussion, Mark Vandroff called in, and we talked about Ukraine a lot. And I saw a real interesting comment that it kind of parallels the same thing. It's the critical wartime danger that's hidden in plain sight, whether you're talking about underwrited cables or you're talking about industrial capacity. And we've talked a lot over the years, even before the Russia-Ukrainian war, quite a few times, about how delicate our real combat power is, in that we're not designed for extended combat at scale. And the Russians are lucky in the fact that they had this huge leftovers from the Soviet Union they could draw on. And they had spent the last 8 years having those accidental explosions at storage facilities in Ukraine that destroyed a lot of their inventory. And Ukraine's been lucky in the fact that they have received a lot of help from the West to get additional weapons and additional expendable ordnance in place. But when you look at us, nobody's coming to our rescue. There's nobody that's a bigger country that produces more than we do. We've got to do what we've got to do. And we've been at peace for so long, besides the last extended war we really had was Vietnam, and that there's some hard math out there that I would love to get some war gamers in to work at, is the problem that the Russians and the Ukrainians are going into is you have expenditures of ordnance X. You have inventory Y. That gives you an outpush when you know how much you're doing per day. How long can you fight this war until you're out of Schlitz? The industrial capacity, and we talked about this briefly in the past, there are great graphs for how fast our fleet grew from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay, but that all started in 1936. It took years to grow the industry to the point that it could really explode at scale to build the size fleet we want. But nations have been at peace for so long that they have, the quote went roughly, nations have been at peace for so long they have forgotten the industrial requirements for conventional warfare. And it'd be really interesting to play it out when you run out, but you haven't run out. You haven't run out.
Red Storm Rising, that was based on a war game that Larry Bond and Clancy were messing around with. And they went Winchester. Remember that one of the scarier things in the book was when all of a sudden you realize, yeah, we shot off all this stuff at useless things. Now here comes the real threat. It is an issue. And it, you know, the other thing is that I was thinking the other day, I said, you know, what was the population of the U.S. in World War II? And it's like 120 million, something like that. So yeah, I'm baffled by the fact we've got 330 million people now, and we can't ratchet up work to get people to do things like build ships and create munitions. What is our workforce doing? And what would happen if the balloon goes up? Who are we going to take from some job where they're, monitoring what people say on Twitter? And are we going to put them into a munitions factory and have them screw, 5-inch rounds together? Where are we going to get these people to do this stuff? And if it can be automated, obviously, it should be able to automate a lot of it, but the missiles, the harpoons, and all that stuff, they seem to be handcrafted by gnomes somewhere. I don't know why they take so long to produce, but maybe you have a concept of that.
Yeah, Patriot missiles are the same way. They're created by artisans. They're to use one of my favorite words. They're exquisite. They are expensive. They're delicate. They have lots of parts. And what's really interesting is, I'll use that word in the Chinese meaning, not in the English meaning. They also have very interesting supply chains. The classic example of that, use another country, is the tactical drones. I refuse to call them kamikaze drones. Our friend Alessio has a good reason why not to call them kamikaze drones, because it's really a Tomahawk kamikaze drone. Anyway, the Iranian tactical drones that the Russians have been using, a couple of them have been shot down. They've done the forensics on it. And so much of what they're made is made in the U.S., is made in Europe, because they can't be made locally. And that's true with a lot of our military infrastructure. You know, there's no – in this huge continent-sized nation of 330 million people – we no longer have a lead smelter. We can't produce our own lead anymore. We shut down the mines. We shut down the smelters. Not because we ran out of lead. It was, again, going back to our bureaucratic friends in D.C. and what they like to do. They shut it down. So if you need lead for anything like, a few billion more small arms ammunition than you thought you were going to need otherwise, you're going to have to import it from somewhere. Or you're going to, how many years does it take to restart a lead mine? How many years does it take to build a lead smelter? I don't know, but I think it's more than one. Less than a decade, more than one, who knows? But that's also part of that interesting view of things. Something that I've wanted to write for a while and I haven't. There's even the maintenance issues. We don't have the capacity to maintain our submarine fleet at peace. What do we do at war when that war goes past 36 weeks and trends toward 36 months? That's when things get interesting for me. Like, what would be very interesting, not interesting, it would be a nightmare. And that's what I think the Russians are counting on. If Ukraine didn't have the Western support that it had, where would we be right now? Well, I think we'd have Russian troops on the Polish border about 6 months ago. But, you know, when a nation of 330 million finds itself, for whatever reason, involved in a predominantly maritime and aerospace war in the Western Pacific with its allies against a nation of 1.4 billion, what type of expenditures do you think we're going to do? How many days, weeks, months, or years can you do that before all the wonderful, exquisite weapons you want to use, which I think the Russians are about to run out of some of their ballistic and cruise missiles.
They'll just bring some World War II airplane. They kept everything, so they're they'll fly some variation of a B-29 and continue to bomb people. So
they'll find something. It's like the old Einstein quote, except it doesn't have nuclear weapons. He said the World War III will be fought with nuclear weapons. World War IV will be fought with sticks and stones. When wars don't end just because somebody runs out of their favorite weapon, you're going to have to use something. Or maybe, maybe it's like a bar fight. The person that can pass out last wins. That might be it, too.
Well, one of the problems we face with China is that they are, because of the way they are structured, they can turn building ships into a whole of government operations. So they, they can do the things we did during World War II during peacetime. And, for us to go back to a wartime footing would require, again, almost a whole of government process, which I'm not optimistic that we could do that without some really serious threat. I mean, we came close right after 9/11, where everybody was kind of on the same page and all that. But, even then we were using equipment that already existed. So I don't know if we could gin up for a major. And I assume that the bad guys are thinking the same way. Oh, the Americans are too soft. They won't do what they need to do to get ready.
Yeah, people have always underestimated us, but unfortunately, we always tend to underestimate other people. People forget how hard we tried to stay out of World War I, how hard we tried to stay out of World War II, while our potential enemies had no problem going to war. And on paper, they were bigger and stronger than we are. On paper, we're bigger and stronger now, but the one thing that I'm seeing some of, and I hope we get more of, into the conversation is not just on the Navy side, but really nationally. Forget the little tactical details of what's going on in the Russia-Ukrainian war. The macro lesson coming out of there right now: capacity, capacity, capacity. The Russians thought they were going to have a three-day war. They're coming up on 10 months, and it doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. We have a lot of people who are in charge of our nation's national security who are not thinking or are not planning, and they're definitely not funding, a long war on the other side of the Pacific. And there's a lot of folks who are talking about it and complaining about it, but I don't see action, and I don't know what it's going to take to get that action. Will we get the people we need after the 2024 election that are willing to do the hard work for years on end to produce something they'll probably never see, because these things don't happen overnight? The pre-World War II, like I said, that buildup started half a dozen years before the war began. Are we going to get an administration and a Congress who's willing to do that? I don't know, but it's not going to happen until enough people have knowledge of it and pressure of it, which I guess we're the little cricket chirping. Hopefully we'll get some louder creatures, and there are louder creatures. There are good people up on the Hill, and there are good people in industry who know this and are pushing as well. And but we're going to have to see that movement. But at least it'll provide us plenty of topics to talk about on future Midrats, because the problem is getting worse. And one advantage is we have a recent conflict that we can point to that's ongoing, that you can use those lessons that people by the tens of thousands are dying over to turn into policy and priorities on our end that hopefully can prevent tens of thousands of our people dying when the next war comes.
Yeah, it's interesting to me that some of the damage to the Russian armor is being done is from the old-fashioned anti-tank mines. those are not that complicated. Yeah, those are not that hard to make. So, you know, if you don't mind filling your country up with a bunch of things you have to dig up later on to render inert, you know, that does work. Sometimes the simple things, as we discovered during the Gulf War, we had a few of our ships run into World War I type mines. In fact, it might have been World War I mines. You know, you don't have to have the sleekest, newest missile system to cause a hell of a lot of damage and ruin somebody's day. Sometimes you just need to go back to the basics.
And I think who developed it? There's some company out there that has a great little PowerPoint presentation where, you know, everybody wants to talk about mission modules and modularity. They literally have developed a mine lane system that's in a issue ISO Connex box. And basically all you need to do is drop it on the back of your ship, have a way for them to roll off the end, and there you go. So you now have any ship as a mine layer. All you have to do is put that Connex box and get enough duct tape and bailing wire to secure it to the deck, and off you go. It's, but that's been true for over 100 years.
Yeah, what was that Iranian ship that we grabbed that
something in a jar?
Yeah, that was the simple mine layer you just described.
Yeah. Well, hey, we just chewed up a whole hour, and I appreciate everybody that's in the chat room. And just to give everybody a little premonition, next week we believe we have secured a guest that's going to give us a graduate-level seminar on the real dangers when it comes to cyber. Everybody likes to say cyber this, cyber that, but the truth is a little scary out there. It's what our buddy, the late great Raymond Pritchett, did on the civilian side of the sector, and this will kind of open that aperture. And more to follow. So keep an eye on Eagle One and myself's Twitter feed, our blogs, and we'll let you know about next week's guest. We should firm it up a little bit, so that'll be a nice little early Christmas present for everybody.
Yeah, thanks everybody for being here today.
And we appreciate everybody joining us for another edition of MidRats. And Jerry, thank you for calling in. And until next time, hope everybody has a great Navy Day. Cheers.